Masculinity is not something given to you, but something you gain, and you gain it by winning small battles with honor. That was all about honor. That was all about calling to courage. Let's bring Stephen Mansfield back up. Come on, Stephen.
So guys, I want to talk to you about four maxims and four principles, and here they go. The first one is going to sound a little funny. Manly men do manly things. Now, that sounds a little obvious, like, you know, elephants do elephant things and dogs do dog things and all that kind of thing. You know what I mean? Sounds a little obvious. But I've learned something in working with men, and I think it is consistent with Scripture, that really the focus that we need in our generation right now, and certainly one of the great truths for men, is that the doing needs to be the focus. Now, don't misunderstand me. I'm not trying to say the doing as opposed to the healing. I'm not trying to say, I'm not trying to create some new version of legalism, some new list, you know, all-purpose list that makes you a man. That's not the case. But for most men, the pressing need is for them to do the things that a manly man is supposed to do. In fact, I actually believe that the healing is in the doing. Let me see if I've, there we go. Didn't quite get that click. The healing is in the doing. For a lot of men, and in a lot of men's movements, the message is, again, I'm not critical of anybody. I'm thankful for anybody who's talking to men and making them better. But the message that guys get is that we want to change your emotions. We want to do emotions management, you know? Let's go on a retreat. Let's all feel differently when we leave. Well, you will feel differently. We want that. I mean, that we want you to feel differently after tonight. But the effect we're going for is not primarily emotional. This is the thing that men fear the most. For men, emotions are the byproduct of doing the right things, doing what we're called to do, you know, of engaging, right? Emotions often don't come first for us. And that's okay. It's okay. Now, I don't assume you're shut down. I don't assume you're unemotional. I don't assume you don't have feelings. You know how much we believe in the opposite. You can tell by how I speak and the fun I have. And, you know, I mean, you know, if there's anybody not emotionally shut down, it's this man right here. Look at the movies he's watching, by the way, you know. The guy laughing the most at the exploding whale last night, some of you weren't here, but he showed a whole video clip of the exploding whale as he's seen 90 times. He sat up here and laughed his head off, you know. The other guys are going, that's funny. I mean, they were laughing, but he's like, he can't even hardly talk, you know. So emotionally shut down is not what we're going for here. However, if we're talking about the on-ramp for manhood, the healing is in the doing for a lot of us and not primarily in trying to rearrange the furniture of our emotional life, which is what a lot of guys feel like that's what they're being asked to do. There are some scriptures that show us the priority of the doing. You know, I think that we maybe coming out of our American church culture, which I'm grateful for the positive aspects of, many times we get the impression that God has to do something first, or we have to have the big dramatic spiritual or emotional experience before we can actually act, that's kind of a launch into acting. But if that's true, and it probably is for a lot of us, some of us have real encounters with God, and that's what causes us to do things differently, there's at least an additional perspective in Scripture that I think is maybe more pressing for us now. In Luke 17, verses 11 through 14, we've got this great story that, of course, you know. Jesus encounters some lepers. It says that now on his way to Jerusalem, Jesus traveled along the border between Samaria and Galilee. And as he was going into a village, 10 men who had leprosy met him. And they stood at a distance and called out in a loud voice. And it says, Jesus, they said, Jesus, Master, have pity on us. When he saw them, he said, go show yourselves to the priests. Let's pause there. If you know anything about leprosy in the Bible, about the worst news you could give a leper was go show yourselves to the priest. It was a priest who had told these lepers that they had leprosy. It was a priest who said, you're now going to have to go away from the community, live out in the boondocks, ring a bell, shouting unclean, unclean as you approach. You know, you've seen Ben-Hur. You know what that looked like, you know, a leper colony away from the society. So the priests were the guys who said, no, you are now banned. That would have been almost the technical term in Hebrew. You are now banned. You can't be near society. You have leprosy. So for Jesus not to heal them right there and to say, go show yourselves to the priest, I want you just to put a little space between these two sentences, the last two sentences there. At that moment, they had to feel real let down. Oh, man, show ourselves to the priest. These are the blankety blanks that sent us out here in the first place. That's no fun. Look at the last sentence. And as they went, they were healed. What came first? The doing. You see what I mean? They did what they were supposed to do, and God acted in their lives. Please, I'm the last guy to try to create some kind of legalism. If you do the right thing, God will love you. No, no, no. We all know that's not true, right? But there is a truth that doing and obeying is what puts you in a position for God to partner with you and to move into your life in a more profound way. That's clearly in Scripture also, okay? So there's a principle. The one I like a lot is this one. In 2 Kings 5:14, there's a guy I really enjoy. His name is Naaman. And Naaman, I guess I have a thing for Arabs. Naaman is basically an ancient Arab. And he's a high-ranking military commander. You know, he's the Colin Powell or Schwarzkopf of his era. And he, too, contracts leprosy. Okay? So he's heard about the prophet. He's heard that the prophet can do miracles. So he goes and sees the prophet. What does the prophet tell him to do? Go dip yourself into the river 7 times, the prophet says. Well, this is like, you know, Norman Schwarzkopf in full uniform. You know, this is Colin Powell in full uniform, or maybe better, you know, Prince Philip in England, because the English can have some stuff on their uniforms. You know, they look awesome. And he didn't want to dip himself in the river. That's what servants do. You don't dip yourself in the river. And there's this great statement in the Bible. It says, finally, a servant girl at his house convinces him to go do what the prophet said. It says, so he went down and dipped himself in the Jordan 7 times, and as the man of God had told him to do, and his flesh was restored and became clean like that of a young boy. Now, again, look at the order. He's told to do something. He refuses to do something. The supernatural thing he's hoping for doesn't happen. When he finally does what he's told to do, that's when the supernatural happens. I'm not saying it's the only way God works. I'm just saying it's in the Bible, too. It's part of the mix. It's part of the package. And so, What is not under our control is how fast we heal or what we always feel emotionally, right? I mean, we can't always, I can't guarantee you what emotions I'll be in at 8:32 tomorrow morning. I mean, I'm not saying I'm going to go postal over at the hotel and do damage. I'm just saying I don't know exactly what I'll be feeling at 8:32. I can tell you whether I'll be obedient. I can tell you whether I'll do the right things in the lives of my wife and Isaac and, you know what I'm saying? I can tell you that I'll be a man committed to God, committed to Jesus, and trying to do the right thing. So when it comes to manhood, the doing, I believe, is the beginning of the healing. And for most men, this is really critically the issue. In fact, I like this film clip. Let me let it take us into the reason that often the doing is the critical thing. This is from Black Hawk Down. And by the way, I this is the moment that I get to say the introduction to my book is written by General Jerry Boykin. And if you've seen Black Hawk Down, how many of you have seen? Okay, some of you are going to heaven. Right? You got to get a Bible, love Jesus, and watch a certain list of movies to go to heaven. No, I'm just playing. But if you've seen Black Hawk Down, the general that Sam Shepard plays is Jerry Boykin, who wrote the introduction to the book that what we're doing tonight is based on. This is just a little clip. I'll explain it in a minute. Now, I like that because here's this officer who's telling the guy to do something, and he goes, but I'm shot, I'm hurt. And what's the response of the officer? We're all hurt. We're all shot. Now, please don't misunderstand what I'm about to say. We obviously believe in Psalm 23 that God restores the soul. We obviously believe that God wants to heal our wounds. We obviously believe that, that God wants to fix the stuff that's wrong with us, whether it's addictions or damage that's been done to us. I mean, some people in this room, if you're an average group, and I the stats, some of people in here have sustained some horrible damage in their lives, and we believe that God heals and restores those things. I'm not laying that aside. What I am saying, though, is that, and please hear me not being overly critical, but when men are hurt, they tend to talk. And talking replaces doing. You understand what I mean? When men are hurt, and this is why I think that Buzz is doing such a great job of really leading you men, because he's not about sitting around and let's just talk about, you know, what's gone on with us. You want to have that, and I'll come to that a little later. You want to have men, you want to talk, you want to have guys you can trust, you want to have guys you can unpack your experience to. But you never want to lose sight of the fact that the doing is what a man is called to, almost as the beginning, almost as the launch, as the step up. Do we teach our young boys whom we're trying to raise into men to feel certain things in order to be a man? You ought to feel a certain way. You ought to respond to William Wallace in a certain way. No, that's not the primary thing, right? We pretty much know they're feeling a lot of stuff already. That's what, part of what we got to manage. What we want them to do is do the things that a man does. Do the things. And often in a man's life, the things that he does, the tools that he uses, the disciplines that he absorbs in his life, they work from the outside in. Okay, let me just give you a quick little example of how this might work. When I was very small, I think I was maybe four, my father, who was a, you know, Army officer, Special Forces, Green Beret, you know, obviously phenomenally powerful in my life, turned to me. You know, we were living in Germany, we were getting in the car, I think we were going to the officers' club to have dinner. He turned to me and he said, "Son, get your mother's door for me, will you?" Now, my father could have lectured me about manhood, could have taught me lessons, could have showed me pictures, could have taken me out in the backyard for football, could have shown me soldiers marching. When he said that to me, he asked me to do something, but that doing, that the action was full of meaning. It had meaning to it, and the meaning embedded itself in my soul. I remember so clearly. I don't know why I remember this, but I'm glad I do, just all these years later, so I can relay it to guys like you. When my father said, "Open your mother's door for me, won't you?" I remember thinking, first of all, my mother was a tall, athletic woman, played tennis, you know, kind of very athletic and strong. And I remember just the flash of thought through my mind, well, she's better able to do this than I am. You know how a boy is. It's like, well, me open the door? That's crazy. She's big, strong. She's been opening the door for me for 4 years. What's wrong with that arrangement, you know? But the next flash that went through was just, I mean, non-verbally, my father takes care of my mother. That's what a man does. And he has now enlisted me in this project. He has now brought me into this. It was the doing that began to teach me. Do you follow what I mean? He didn't discipline me, he didn't beat me, he didn't make me recite a code, he didn't make me flex in the mirror, he just said, okay. Within a few weeks, he turned to my mother. I mean, he had decided that at 4 years old, things were going to change for me. He turned to my mother and said, "From now on, Stephen and I'll get the dishes, so you go on and rest in there." He turned to my mother, "From now on, Stephen and I'll get the dishes." You know, I'm looking at him like, have you lost your mind? I mean, you never said that to, you know, Major Green Beret, but that, I remember just thinking in my brain, why is life changing so suddenly and not in my favor? You know, I mean, this was kind of what I was thinking. Well, my father, by the way, who was not a very emotional man, typical kind of military guy, you guys know the type, was, you know, not the kind, I mean, we had a close relationship later, but I'm telling you, until I was about 30, I mean, he'd never even told me he loved me. I mean, he wasn't good at those other things. What he was good at, though, was using disciplines and duties to enlist you in what it meant to be a man. And he would just simply say, "We're going to take care of that for your mother." Or he'd turn to me and say, "You know, us men," when he said "us men" to me when I was five, I was like, "We're awesome. We're men." You know, I'm like, you know, I'm a little spindly-legged kid, you know, and my mom was still dressing me in shorts, but that I got over that. The issue was that Dad just simply brought me into a life of doing, a life of manly doing. It was really, as a father, I don't want you to be insulting. He's dead now. We became very close later. It was the thing he was best at. He wasn't good at all the emotional stuff. He wasn't good at these other things. But he helped me to the extent that I became a man in my early life simply by punctuating the doing that a man ought to do. And in man life, in man code, the doing always carries with it meaning, doesn't it? Open your mother's door for me. Instantly, we men have an obligation. We take care of the women. It's about honor. Because opening the door doesn't really mean much else. It's not like she gets in any faster than she opens it on her own, especially when I was opening the door at 4 years old, you know, trying to get the thing open. And it has nothing to do with capability. It has to do with kind of this thing we want to show them about honor and reverence. I mean, I tell you, instantly that came into my heart. we'll take care of the dishes. Instantly, gratitude for mom. She'd been working. We're going to take care of that. We'll do the heavy stuff. For the rest of, from that point on, whenever anything heavy was being carried in the house by my mother, my father would say, come on, let's get this. I mean, you just got up, you know, and you're thinking, I mean, I'm still in PJs with footies and Mickey Mouse on the front. You know, I mean, what am I going to do, carry this chair out the door? I don't know. But it was the idea. And he also said, let's do it. So I'm enlisted in man code. You know, I'm stepping up for this thing. What I want to say is that manly men do manly things. And what we want to do is start to identify from Scripture, which we believe is the primary code. There are other things that we'll add to and build on in our lives that, you know, Scripture doesn't directly address, but build into our lives the disciplines and the commitment to manly doing. Now, I'm using some big old fat words like doing, but what exactly do you do? What is the doing that men do? So my first principle is manly men do manly things. Let me nail down another one before we hear tonight, and we'll do a little Q&A at the end, pick up the rest in the morning. The second one that sort of explains the first one, I think I've got you maybe open to the idea that the doing is the issue, but the second one that I think is really, really important for us is that manly men tend their field. Now guys, this is critical. This is important. It's why I left it to the last. I always do it tonight so you can give it some thought. I take this principle, we are teaching this, take this principle from 2 Corinthians 10:13. You've heard this maybe in different versions of the Bible, but in 2 Corinthians 10:13, Paul says something that's really, really important. He says, we, however, will not boast beyond proper limits, but will confine our boasting to the sphere of service God himself has assigned to us, a sphere that also includes you. Paul says, there is a sphere. This is the NIV, and normally it's very, very good, but it shouldn't be the word sphere. In Greek, it's the word metron. It means a measured space, basketball court like this, or a soccer field, or a football field, or anything that's measured, anything that's got definitions to it. It's just not a circle, that's all. Sorry, I'm objecting. A field assigned to you. Paul had a field of responsibility assigned him. I don't mean a literal physical field, but that's what we're meant to visualize. There were certain things he was responsible for that season of his life, certain things God had given him to do for that season of his life. It included the Corinthians. He says that it extends even to you. But obviously, there were probably some people it didn't extend to. So Paul knew the definitions of the field assigned to him for that season of his life. He says this in other places in the Bible. Greek word is metron, a measured space. Well, I believe with all my heart that every man, for every season of his life, has a field assigned to him. It's the body of things that God has made for you to do, has given you to do, has assigned to you for a season in your life. And the beginning of manhood, once you accept that it's doing, is primarily to step up and tend the field that God has given you. What is the image of the irresponsible man? It's the Bubba sitting in his like recliner in nasty, sweaty, stinky clothes with holes in them, screaming for somebody to get a beer. The house is falling in around his ears. His wife is 40 pounds overweight and bitter. The daughter's going out with somebody she shouldn't be going out with. The son's upstairs in front of the computer with the door closed doing who knows what. And the guy, all he wants is another beer and sandwich before the game starts again. He's irresponsible. He's neglectful. He's not tending his field, right? And the reason that we know that this is the great sin of men is that we can look at Adam, right? I love in Genesis 3 that as Eve, I don't love it, but I mean, it's a very good illustration for us. While Eve is being tempted by the serpent, where is Adam? Where does the Bible say Adam is? Adam is right there, the Bible says, with her. But there's a game on TV. So he's like, yeah, baby, whatever. Oh. Yeah, okay, cool, honey. He's watching the game down the hall while the devil is tempting Eve to take the whole human race into bondage. Where's Adam? Is he off hunting somewhere? Is he off doing some other duty? Did the enemy come in the door when Adam was out of town? No. Adam's right there, but it's not tending the field assigned to him. He's not taking responsibility for his wife. He's not taking responsibility for the garden. He's not tending what God has given him. And the devil comes in, and in Christian theology, that's the entrance of sin into the world. Now, Let me illustrate this in another way, and I'm about to show you one of the most awesome high school pictures of a guy in the history of the world. Okay, so get ready. Brace yourself. It's going to be overwhelming. Let me illustrate this by, hang on just a minute. Let me illustrate this by something that happened to me in high school. When I was in high school, I think I've told you I was raised in Germany, so I was used to playing soccer. But when I came back to the States in the middle of my high school career, I was tall and kind of strong for my size, but the coaches in my high school, I went to a massive high school in Des Moines, Iowa, had a quarter-mile-long hallway. That's how big this high school is, still does. Valley High School. And the coaches put me at defensive end. Well, you know, I was okay, but I wasn't very smart, and I didn't understand what they were talking about. You know, what does it mean? I was used to soccer terms. What does it mean to contain? What does it mean to string out the play? You know, I don't know what that means. I was just hitting people and waving to people in the stands. What did I know, you know? Well, finally, my coach, who's not pictured here, that's somebody else, came to me, and he told me things about my birth I didn't know. And then he said, meet me on the field at 6 o'clock Monday morning. No, 7 o'clock Monday morning. Okay? I mean, he was furious. And because I just wasn't playing well. When I got there at 7 o'clock on Monday morning, in October, in Iowa, by the way, cold, dark, he had a pair of scissors. And he said to me, you're an idiot. Told me some other things about my birth I didn't know. And then he said, I want you to understand, fool, that this over here is your field. He was standing on the side of the line that I would have been my side as a defensive end. This is your field. You don't understand that, and so you suck. And then he told me more things about my birth. And I want you to own your field, because I want you to understand that this is yours, and nobody comes through here without your permission. I'm like, okay, coach. You know, I didn't understand what was going to happen yet. He said, every morning, until you get this right, you're going to come out here at 7 o'clock, and you're going to mow this field. And then he held up the scissors. And by the way, they weren't great big adult scissors. They were little plastic-gripped child scissors. Then he said some things about the birth of the grass that I didn't know. And he said, you're going to mow this field. He said, you're going to mow this field, and you're going to defend this field. Be here every morning at 7 o'clock. So guys, I'm telling you, West Des Moines, Iowa, Coach Aruchka, which tells you something about him, I went out there, got on my hands and knees, and started to cut the grass with these child scissors at 7 o'clock in the morning on my, you know, in the cold. I'm sure it would be illegal, and I should have sued him at the time, but that wasn't our culture. And something, I think I flipped out, because before long, the grass became my friends, right? And I began to think, you know, when we'd have practice, like, don't step on Herman, because I've been talking to him, you know, at like 7 o'clock in the morning. You don't, whoa, there's George, don't. And I don't mean to make it too weird, but I did start to know the field. I knew the rocks. I mean, I was mowing the grass for 30 minutes every morning in the cold. And I was out there with these scissors. I mean, he was watching me out the window. You know how they are. They got these great big coach windows. So I'm cutting the grass, and I did kind of get to know the field, you know, and I did kind of get defensive. And come practice, basically, you know, I began to realize, don't come this way. Somehow I took ownership of the field. Do you understand the illustration? I mean, even though I went mentally nuts at the time, I understood the field. And pretty much I decided nobody comes this way without my permission. And if you have a ball, you die. That's basically how I began to understand the game. But I became pretty good defensive end over a couple of years playing in Iowa because I owned my field. I owned the field assigned to me. And because I guarded its borders and I took authority over it in a sense, I don't mean that in some taking authority over demons way, I became a pretty good player because I at least understood my assignment. I understood what I was supposed to do. Now, I want to suggest to you that most men don't know that they have a field assigned to them. And therefore, they may not be aware that this is how manhood, authority, being a man manifests itself. One of the things that's interesting to me is speaking to men as much as I do is sometimes the wives get to me before I get a chance to talk to the men, and they're scared. Now, my husband's coming to your thing tonight. You know, what are they worried about? They're worried that they're going to go, you know, you guys are going to go home, and suddenly you'll have a new vision for husbandly authority. And walk in the door and go, I take authority over you in Jesus' name, you know, and start running the house in some way that you're not competent at. You understand what I'm saying. They're afraid because they've had their husbands go to men's things before. And I believe, though, that the authority that we have comes by tending our field and having grace for God for investment and tending what God's given us. If you are here and you are 17 years old, your field may be half of a bedroom and a rusted-out car and some textbooks, a dating life, some chores at home, and your school assignment. Now, that's meager. Maybe you got a part-time job, but that's your field. It's not just that that's what you're doing. You know, that's what God's given you for now. Obeying your parents, you know, being a member of a family, going to school, working your job, taking responsibility for what God has given you. Okay, he may have given you some more things, and you need to ask him what's the field assigned him. You get older, in your 20s, 30s, maybe you have a house, maybe you have an apartment, maybe you have a wife but don't have kids yet. And then there may be other things that God's given you to. Maybe you feel like you're supposed to invest in some neighborhood boys, or maybe you feel like you're supposed to serve at the church, or maybe since you're connected to the church, I feel like, you know, preparing for that missions trip next year is part of the field assigned to me, or I'm meant to work in the men's ministry. You just know the confines of the field assigned to you. And what is key is that you realize that as the man, you are responsible to bring everything into that field, into its fulfillment, into its destiny, into growth, into protection, into healthiness. Right? We're not farming out our responsibilities as so many do. We are tending the field assigned to us. So if I notice that there's this new bitter thing happening in my wife, I can tell she's been hurt, maybe she's a little bit bitter, a little hard, that's my role to come to her and say, hey, I'm noticing some things about you. You know, in Ephesians 5, it says that a man's meant to basically tend his wife the way Christ tends the church. The best translation of that word is guardian coach. Guardian coach. That we're meant to be guardian coaches for our wives. Guard over them, pray over them, protect them, serve them, care for them, and invest in them. So it's my job to do that. My son, you know, I watch his life, I pray for him, I watch what goes on with him. It's my job to take him through the steps of manhood. It's my job to talk to him about what's going on the computer. It's my job to help him, coach him, speak him, model before him, and encourage him into great manhood. My daughter, I love her. I pray for her. I stand with her. I nurture her. I protect her. You know? Every date she ever had, I was like that country music song. You just go on ahead and just come back at 10 o'clock because I'll be here cleaning my gun. I mean, that was, you know, you don't just go, yeah, honey, go on out and I'll see you tomorrow. I mean, why? Because it's your job to stand guard over what God has given you. You understand what I'm saying to you. The house and the yard. But it's not just the physical stuff. It's the whole body of responsibilities that you're given. And what's interesting is that in Luke 11, I won't take you to that verse right now, but in Luke 11, we're told that really, if a man wants true riches, he's got to deal effectively and well with worldly wealth. If he wants to really have riches from God, he's got to deal effectively with other people's money. You know, in other words, the way you deal with natural things, do the things at the earthly level that you're meant to do, that's how you gain authority and strength and grace to do more. Let me give you an example. Years ago, my daughter, who's now 25 and living in New York, but at the time, she was going to a school, and it was one of those schools where you have to pick up the kids, right? So I would go at the end of the school day, and I would pick her up. Well, she told me something one day. She said, Dad, it's very interesting. She's about 17. It's very interesting. When you walk into the atrium, this was a big room like this where parents would pick up their kids in the big atrium of this school. When you walk into the room, she said, I'm talking to a boy. And I can see you walk in the room over his shoulder, but he doesn't know you've walked in the room. She said, it's so interesting. She said, every time you walk in the room, and by the way, let me say, she's pretty stout. She would not be letting any boy talk nasty to her, so that's not what's going on. She said, when you walk in the room, every boy I've ever talked to, and when I saw you walk in the room, he gentles up. He gets a little bit more respectful. She said, a couple of times, some of the boys have taken a step back. She said, she's always teasing me about how big I am compared to her friends. She, you know, I'm 6'4", about, it's none of your business how much I weigh. And she would say, I would expect that if they could see you, but they can't see you. She said, you walk in the room, and the boy I'm talking to gentles up a little bit, sometimes becomes a little bit more respectful. She said, one guy messed up and called me ma'am, my age. You know, he just let it out like he was talking to his mother. And a couple of the guys took a step back. She said, now we keep talking, we're still friends, but there's a change in their condition. And you know what that is? I don't mean to be spooky or weird or, you know, overly mystical. Of course I have authority for her life. Of course I carry authority for her life. I have prayed for her since she was in the womb. I have invested in her, disciplined her, encouraged her, protected her. I had a dream one night while she was on a date, and I showed up where they were having the date, and she was in trouble. I mean, I don't mean to act like I'm some kind of big prophet. I'm just a dad, and I ask for God's help to tend the field assigned to me. Do you follow what I'm saying? She might be 17 and out on a date, but she's in my house. I tend that field. So I showed up one night. I just had a dream, and it disturbed me, and I knew where they were. And I went out there, and things had gone really bad, and she was trying to figure out how to get home. And when I drove up, I want you to know the whole scene changed, right? Because when Dad shows up, when suddenly the booze has come out and the porn's on the TV and the kids are upstairs at some house they shouldn't have been at, things change. What am I trying to say? Why did I have authority in her life? Because by God's grace, late in my life, I came to understand I got to tend my field. So my daughter has been in a field that's assigned to me, and I have nurtured her and loved her and gone for walks with her to help her lose weight and explain boys to her and disciplined her and restricted her and taught her math and worked her through her history homework. You know what I'm talking about. 18 years of investment and praying for her and tending the field in which she is raised. Absolutely, I have authority for her life. Absolutely, when I walk in the room, the spiritual dynamics around her change. Of course, you don't have to be hyper-charismatic or, you know, mystically weird to believe that. That's how a man gets authority, is that he takes responsibility. Why didn't Adam have authority to drive the enemy off? Because he'd abandoned responsibility. He'd abandoned responsibility, sitting there just watching the game or whatever he was distracted by while his wife is carried off by the enemy. So it is the field assigned to you that is the issue for you. It is the field assigned to you that a man needs to understand. We must begin to do the things we're called to do, and where do we do them and how do we do them? We do them first by tending the field assigned to us. It doesn't mean that we go home as experts on authority. It doesn't mean we start commanding people. Let me give you a principle. I hope you'll write this down or memorize it. You have a destiny, but your destiny is fulfilled by investing in the destinies of others. You have a destiny, but your destiny is fulfilled by investing in the destinies of others. Pastor Mark has got a destiny. He's a man called. He's a man called with a purpose and a destiny. How's his destiny fulfilled? By standing on stage and being worshipped? No, by investing in your lives, teaching you guys, investing in you. He fulfills his destiny by helping you fulfill your destiny. Whatever you're called to do, you have a destiny. But your destiny is fulfilled by investing in the destinies of others. It's very, very important. So, men who are caught away with this generation and who are drawn away by the enemy and the flesh, the devil, and the world, what do they start doing? They start abandoning their responsibilities. Well, so what happens is people start lecturing men, you need to be more responsible and so on, and you know, it just becomes like a behave yourself kind of lecture. But I'm talking about spiritual things here. If we want a restoration of righteous manhood, we have to occupy the territory we've been assigned. Every man in here has been assigned a field. And I want to suggest to you that this is one of the great arts of living. That if you tend the field assigned to you to its boundaries, if you know what God has given you for any season of your life, you have grace for that field. If you go beyond those boundaries, go beyond that field, what happens? Stress, burnout. You know, we learned, and for those of us who went to Sunday school, I didn't. I became a believer, as I've said, at about 18. But for those of you who went to Sunday school, you may have heard some statement like, get under the spout where the glory comes out, right? In other words, what you want to do is be positioned before God so that his grace and his power are yours. Well, when a man takes responsibility for the field assigned him, he says, Lord, I understand what you're giving me to do. Understand what's in this season of my life and the field. I ask for your grace and your power to do it. If that man is tending that field right up to its boundaries, right up to the extent that he's meant to and called to and assigned to, he'll have grace for everything he's meant to do. You get much more crammed into your field than is ordained for you in that season. That's why stress and burnout starts to happen in many cases, because there's not the grace of God to tend what you've got. And if a man is much restricted, if he's tending a much smaller thing than what God's assigned to him, there'll never be growth and increase because he's not up to the extent of what God's given him. If we were on a retreat and had 3 or 4 days, I would start to ask you, what's the field assigned to you for this season of your life? What is the field assigned to you for this season of your life? I mean, again, the scriptures use the word, metron, a measured space. Now, I'm not saying you can take your measuring tape out and figure out what it is, but I do believe that if we'll pray and ask the Lord and take stock of our lives, that we can make a list that's pretty close. I do believe we can pretty much figure out what's in it and what's not. And by the way, it changes seasonally. One of the arts of life is knowing when a season change happens. You know, it's a little bit mystical for me to talk about this, but, you know, we all know things are changed. I don't think for this season of my life I'm meant to be involved in this, but I think God's emphasizing this other thing in addition to the other things that are in my field. What am I saying? You need to know the field assigned to you for the season of life you're in. And by the way, I mean spiritual season and not just middle age or adolescence or whatever. The season of life. Let me use Buzz as an example just because, you know, we're getting to know each other and we're friends and he won't hurt me. Buzz has certain seasons in his life. I'm sure if he told us his life, there's a certain season. Maybe he told me earlier he was involved in Christian music and did certain things. That was a season. God probably made it obvious it was time to change. And I don't know if he came here and went somewhere else, but there was a season. You know, there was a time period during which he was, involved in something different. And then maybe the Lord, who knows? He was running a business and the Lord made it clear, it's really time for you to invest in men, or it's time for you to serve this church that's your church. Or I don't know exactly how he came. Season change. Priorities change. Maybe the kids leave home and he and his wife pray and, we're really supposed to give to certain things. We really are supposed to be in India next year for missions. We sense that that's the part of the season of our life. You understand what I'm saying? Spiritual seasons. There are two words used for time in the Bible. One is chronos. We get our word chronological from it. 1 minute after another, 1 day after another, 1 week after another, etc. But the other one is kairos, and it means seasonal time. Conditional time. Some people say strategic time. It means time defined by conditions rather than by a clock. Okay? What season of life are you in? I don't mean that in terms of I'm adolescent or I'm middle age or I'm a senior. That's a different kind of season. I'm talking about the seasons of your life that God leads you into. A season where there are certain priorities. A season where certain things are assigned. A season where you know who you are. A season where you're going to college, working a part-time job, maybe serving a bit at the church, and you know what God's given you for now. You protect that. You don't go too far. You don't go beyond it, and you don't go narrower than that. The other thing is that, and this leads into the things we'll break into tomorrow morning. Once you begin to understand that a man's calling is to take responsibility for what's assigned to him, we stop giving things up to other people. If I'm aware that my son maybe is in some sexual confusion, I'm not quite sure what's going on behind the closed door with the computer, and I found the Playboy or the whatever up in his room, whatever's going on. I don't go, man, I hope a coach talks to him. Wow, I really hope that the health teacher or school talks to him, or his mother, that'd be better. I hope his mother, no. I own my field. You follow what I'm saying? It's my field. My field. I don't have to do everything, but I do need to make sure everything gets done. You don't want me fixing your car, for sure. It'll never run, turn into a dishwasher or something. It'll never run right. You don't want me fixing your car, but I'll make sure it gets done. I won't leave it to my wife. When I first started learning this, I would walk into our home, and if a light bulb was out, I'd go do it right away. My wife would say, come to bed. Goodness, you can do that tomorrow. But I knew in my soul that if I started neglecting things, it's kind of that broken glass theory of neighborhoods and so on. If you don't fix it, then it just gets neglected. This was the theory that, who's the famous mayor of New York that cleaned up Times Square? I've forgotten his name. Giuliani, thank you. He ran for president. I consult in politics, and I can't remember the man's name. Giuliani said it's broken window theory. If we start neglecting, if we start cleaning things up and fixing stuff, it'll change everything. When a man starts doing that, grace starts happening. And I'll tell you what, this extends to everything. This extends to everything. Young man goes on a date, okay? Once he understands what I'm talking about right now, it's never going to be, how far will she let me go? It's never going to be, what can I do? No. He shows up responsible for what will and will not happen. You follow what I'm saying? He has been taught, I mean, in the ideal situation, I didn't learn any of this when I was dating and nearly blew up my life as a result. But once I began to understand this and older men began to teach me, I'll tell you what, it wasn't a question of how far things could go or what could happen or, you know, would we end up drunk or, you know, just kind of, you know, you just kind of let things float. No. I took responsibility. We're going to have a great time. We're going to get to know each other. I've got the evening pretty much figured out, and I'm not going to give occasion to be doing stuff I'm not supposed to be doing. Why? Because I am a man tending his field to the glory of God. I am a man living under the authority of God. I am a man who is not there to see how far the boundaries can go if I just act irresponsible enough. Gee, she wanted to do. No. I'm owning this puppy. This is a date. I own it. Job, I own responsibility for that. You follow what I'm saying? I'm not saying you have to be all legalistic and perfectionist about everything, but you've got to man the moral boundaries of your life and not get squishy at the edges. Why? Because it pleases Jesus, because you'll have grace for your life, and because it's the beginning of a man from the inside beginning to own the field assigned to him. This is what causes a lot of that inner manly insight, grace, anointing, a lot of what's been stolen, a lot of that small-souled stuff we saw on the screen, oligosuchus, this is what begins to expand the vision. This is what begins to cause a man to step up into his ownership of his life. Passive manhood's killing us. Passive, entertainment-oriented, distracted manhood is killing us. I'm going to own my field. And you know what that is? That's me, in a sense, partnering with God to make sure that everything grows according to his will, things are tended, people are loved, things are protected, we pray, we stand, we own, we serve, and this is how God partners with us, and we become, I think, to a major degree, the men we're called to become. Does it mean there's no fun? Does it mean there's no rowdiness? Does it mean it's all duty? No, you're going to find out tomorrow that I believe just the opposite. I think most of you probably aren't having enough fun in a good, clean, and rowdy sense. But the reality is that if we're talking about the on-ramp of righteous manhood, focus on the doing, and the doing primarily comes together in tending our field. So let me just ask you, before we go into a little Q&A, what is the field assigned to you for this season of your life? I'm not going to ask you to say it out loud. What is that field? What has God given you to do for this season of your life? I mean, those of you married, you know, got kids and a house, I mean, obviously that's on the list. We don't even have to wonder about that. What else is it? What are the other priorities? What else has God given you to do? What is in the definition of the field assigned to you? This doesn't have to come from a letter written by angels, but it is a matter of seeking God. It is a matter of seeking God. And until you're fairly sure of that and you're dutifully manning that, growth increase may not come. I mean, ideally, the people who pastor our churches, who are the officials in our government, the people who lead us in other things, they're what? They're people who have already done this. Ideally, we want people who are ramping up and who are growing from these principles further. We have, Buzz, do we have 10 minutes for Q&A?
Sure.
Okay. So this is what I'd like for you to think about tonight. Tomorrow morning, I'm going to build on this, but these two things are the beginning. Now, some of you are going to go, you know, I've already pretty much on top of the doing. Okay, good. Then let's begin to look at the field assigned to us. Let's begin to look at the field assigned to us. This is where, I believe, manhood really kicks in for most men. And for young men, this discipline, this art of knowing the season, knowing the field assigned, is what will kick it in. Tomorrow we'll get more practical, and we'll also have a little bit more fun. So let me just take a few more minutes here, about 10 minutes. Any questions about this? Anything you want to ask about this? Anything coming to mind that you want to know? And he's got a mic. Take a minute and think about anything I said tonight that you want to ask.
Yeah, just raise your hand. I'll be a talk show host. Wait a minute.
How long have you been giving this seminar?
I'm sorry?
The question was, how long have you been giving this seminar?
Well, I mean, I've been talking to men for 20 years, but this particular seminar I've done since this book came out, which somebody opened it up and tell me, I think was 12. Was it 12? 13. What's it say on the inside of the book for somebody who's got it? Seriously, that's when I started this. I wrote this particular seminar just after the book came out. So what's the date on the copyright in there? 13. So, you know, a couple of years ago. All right.
Oh, right here. Do you have a strategy of key things you want to focus on first so you don't get in a situation where you're overwhelmed trying to boil the ocean in terms of what you need to focus on for managing your field?
Yeah. The first thing is to define it, right? Second thing is to start is to figure out what does require priority. And I'm not saying this just for, you know, to be sound spiritual, but always prayer, owning that in the kind of in the invisible realm is critical. If you're married, it would be your wife next, right? There's a school of parenting discipline called Raising Kids God's Way. And it says that kids are secure when mom and dad are taken care of. So part of the problem is mom and dad tend to focus on the kids and neglect each other. And if mom and dad are sitting together on the couch going, we have decided, the kids go, even if they go, oh, mom, oh, dad, they feel the solidarity of that. They feel the, so wife would be next. So spiritual things, wife, okay? I would say then, this will surprise a lot of you, that the next thing in priority, again, you got to pray about the priorities, but I'm saying just as if you're looking for a little bit of a rule, is the man himself, okay? You know, when you get on an airplane, what do they say? Put the oxygen mask on your face first before you try to chase that kid around, because you're going to die chasing the kid up the aisle, you know, trying to put the oxygen on him, right? That's the video they show us to scare us all when we get on the airplane. Sorry for those of you who work for airlines. And the reason is, until you take care of yourself, you can't take care of anybody else. So you always have to be investing in your wife if you're married, but I think there's also a place to take care of yourself. You know, what do you need to deal with? Well, as I start to own righteous manhood and own the field assigned to me, I realize I'm a very angry man. I'm drinking too much. I'm addicted to double stuff Oreos. I just confessed my big sin. You know, whatever it is. Or I do want to own righteous manhood, but I got a serious porn thing going on behind the scenes. You know, whatever it is. Get the fix, and I'm going to talk about this specifically tomorrow, so put a little space saver there. And then move out from there. Again, I don't want you to see it as a big list of, oh, here's what I got to do. It's a joy. It's what you're made for. It's owning what God's given you and no longer walking around feeling kind of hunkered down and guilty. So at least that's the priority. And then I don't want to give you ironclad principles beyond that, not because I couldn't give you a whole list, but I don't want it to be a list. It's your family. It's your house. It's your wife. It's your culture. It's your field. You know more. You're going to know. Give it some prayer and some thought. You'll know more about it than I am. I'm not dodging the question. I'm just saying, there's your start, and after that, you know, for all I know, you're on a rabbit farm, and the rabbits need to be taken care of. You know, I don't want to go too far with that, but the main thing is, please don't feel fear about this, the main thing is that you start owning your field. Own your field, right? My daughter's 25 and up in New York, she's still in my house. My son's 29, they're both normal dating people, neither one of them married, he runs a restaurant back in Nashville, and they don't live in my house, but when I sense a tremor in the force, when I have a little thing on the inside of me that says something's wrong, I call, I tend, what's going on? Tell me the truth. You know, I'm your daddy. I brought you in this world. I'll take you out. You know, I steal the line from Cosby, you know.
Look me in the eyes.
Look me in the eyes. No, look me in the eyes. No, seriously, look me in the eyes, you know. And it's not that I'm suspecting sin. It's that I want to know how they're doing, and I tend. If I go back to the room tonight, my wife's name is Bev. Some of you will meet her later. You know, something's gone wrong. I'm going to find out what it is. I mean, I'm not going to bore into her. I'll give her space. Basically, my attitude is I take responsibility. And so that's your start. Yes, sir.
I have a question about dealing with the mass media, the movies, the TV, because my personal opinion, I'm 70-plus years old.
You say that with shock, like I'm 70-plus.
Anyhow, it seems like the past 20-plus years, everything in Hollywood or TV or whatever tries to demasculate the male character, okay? And looking for women to be the heroes and all this and that. But when it comes to, like, when you're raising the kids and they start watching that TV stuff, first thing they find out is, you know, a guy is nothing but a joker and the women have to run the roost. And how do you fight that?
Yeah, I mean, guys, this is one of the things that got me into writing about this and teaching about this. Those of you who know anything about my writing life, I'm mainly about faith, politics, history. I wrote this book because exactly of this. Two things. The kids asking me on the campus, what do we do, what do we do, what do we do? And then seeing how men are portrayed on TV. I mean, you guys have got to have felt the anger. Every, you know, middle-aged guy is an idiot. You know, he's either... you know, doing a happy dance because he found the remote in the couch, you know, while the wife and kids are in the kitchen rolling their eyes. How many commercials do we see like that? or he's some kind of lech, you know, hanging out at the pole, shoving 20s into somebody's underwear. I mean, this is how men are portrayed in almost every case. And what I don't go around condemning society a lot, because society is doing what society does. Paul even said in his letters to Corinthians, I didn't tell you guys, you know, to condemn those who are sinners, because if you're going to separate from those who are sinners, you'd have to leave the world. That's what people do. That's their job description. They're sinners. The issue is that we don't have an alternative culture that is strong to stand against it. So that is the portrayal of men out there. The question is, are we caught up in it, or are we a reflection of it? So once you start to stand firm and own your field, then you're providing an answer to that, a counter to that. You can't stop the world from having these bad. You're not going to stop porn between now and tomorrow. You know, what you can do is make sure it's not invading your house. It's not in your house. It's not the way you talk. And you can make sure that the way you're living is a counter to all of this. One of the things that's been a little bit of a compliment that I deeply treasure in my life, just a little bit, is did you guys see this great moment in the riots in Baltimore where the 16-year-old kid was doing it, his mama came up and just started slapping him silly and dragging him away? Well, my wife and I live both in D.C. and Nashville, and in D.C. I am about 5% on staff at a huge African-American church. Every so often, a mama will come just like that with her 17-year-old boy and plunk him down in front of me and say, you tell him now, you know. I love that because she's thinking, somebody needs to talk to this boy. Now, there are a lot of black men. I'm not saying it's better because I'm white. I'm just saying I'm the guy talking about this stuff in church, right? Because, you know, I'm not the men's minister, but I'm they call me the white spot on staff. And I'm delighted to do it. And so every so often, a mama who's single just had about enough. And what she wants is a culture shift. And one time she said, you get in that, don't you leave until he makes you leave. You drink up, you know, you just sit there and you just soak it up because you're so bad, you know. And she's dishonest case. Well, what's going on? Thank God, I've learned stuff from my pagan days, you know, since that time. And around me is a culture of some righteous manliness. Around you is a culture of righteous manliness. Around, you know, so she realized that she wants to put her son in it. That's the issue. Do we have a culture that's both spiritual and values and what's said and what's actually physically there in which righteous manhood is being encouraged, strengthened, and people are benefiting from it? And so the answer is we can't fix what's out there in the world. And you guys will notice that I don't actually take the approach, you know, let me be really blunt. I'm not, it'll sound like I'm critical of churches. I'm not. Like I joked last night, I'm a member of two churches. I'm definitely going to heaven. But what is interesting is that in a lot of churches, a lot of men's approaches, the thing is basically based on guilt. The approach is based on guilt. Well, I love you, and I want you to be righteous men, but I believe if I call you to be noble, great men, then I don't have to sit here and guilt slap you about porn and masturbation and, right? A man who wants to be a great man will lay that garbage aside, right? A man who wants to be a great man is not going to go out tonight and down a bottle of whiskey or eat a whole case of Oreos or watch, you know, HBO late night, Friday night porn or whatever it is that we want to list. So I'm not going to spend a lot of time talking about it. I know it needs to be dealt with, but the thing I can do the most is call you to greatness. I can't fix, you know, the porn industry. I can't drive off the porn industry. I can't keep booze from being sold or, you know, whatever. The issue is not the booze being sold. The issue is how much you're drinking if you're over drinking. You understand my point. So I get your point, and I, too, am angry about the depictions, but I decide I can't fix what, you know, Madison Avenue does about man, because, quite frankly, they're just showing us a mirror of what a lot of men are. What I want to do is fix the culture. Okay, I think we got time for one or two more questions. Yes, sir? Wait a minute. He's over here.
Where am I going?
He's over here, and I think he's bigger than I am, so get over there real quick. And
where am I going? Who has the question?
No, I don't need a mic.
You don't need a mic. The guy doesn't need a mic.
He doesn't need a mic.
Finally,
Yes.
Christians are under attack, and Jews are too for them.
Oh, yeah.
So at what point do those people unite and say, we've had enough, we will separate ourselves, we will form our own nation, whatever we do to get away from what appears to be a society that is literally killing.
Yeah, I'm with you. I understand exactly what you're asking. Let me put it back to you semi-humorously, and that is that I'm actually got a little trick involved in what I'm saying tonight. Because if I can get men to own what God's given them to do and step up and own their field and take responsibility and be righteous men and so on, there's going to come that moment when, having tended what God's given them here, they begin to actually be clearer about what's going on in society, what the evils are, what the threat is, and they begin to address it. Right now, we've got a generation, for the most part, again, you guys are here, and I commend you for that, of passive men. So they don't care about anything you just said. As long as there's, you know, food and, you know, toys and porn and whatever, the wife behaves or the girlfriend is doing the right stuff or whatever, that's where it is. I think we should be more active. I mean, remember, I'm a guy who works in D.C. and hangs with the very people you're mentioning. Not John Brown, by the way. I'm not that old, but Huckabee. But what I know is that my talk tonight was, let's go take on the porn industry. Well, I've watched a lot of people get cause-oriented, and until they have the solid foundation of tending the fundamentals in their lives, so to speak, the stuff that God's given them, they don't have the foundation, they don't have the clarity, they don't have the base from which to address society. So I'm about the society. I'm about changing it. By the way, nothing will change society faster than righteous men beginning to understand what is a danger to church, community, home, and so on, and the fact that we should get active with it. One of my great heroes is Theodore Roosevelt, and he said, because I have tended my home, because I've stood as God's man in my home, I can stand as God's man in the nation. And so I'm not about us retreating, but I'm about us owning first things first, so to speak. Now, I want to see men in this room, yes, address the issues in society and begin to create a greater separation. That's what the word holiness means, is hagia, set apart, being distant from, having some kind of a gap between the unrighteousness and us. So I'm with you. What I'm trying to do is get men into a place where they have the sense of moral responsibility and ownership that they will address those issues in society, and they will separate when they need to, even to the point of risking their lives. And, you know, the church that I attend, a lot of the Washington Redskins attend, and when the riot started in Baltimore, they all got in their cars and drove up there and began to back young men off. Did you see the picture of the African-American guys lined up in front of the policemen, protecting the policemen with their bodies? Some of those guys were from the church I attend. What I'm trying to say is, because these guys had owned their homes, owned their field assigned to them, they knew what their duty was when a crisis hit. And that's I think, the response that I can generate at this point. Thanks for the question.
Yeah.
Good question. Let's do one more, how about it, and then we'll call
wanna
it.
Want to do
back.
One more?
Oh, I'm sorry, were you gonna call it to a quit?
I think we can, finishing on that light note tonight.
Yeah.
Yeah, that,
you guys,
that light note.
You guys stink. I'm just playing.
We're going to take it on.
See you.
But thank you, Stephen.
You betcha.
Thanks
you
for
bet.
The questions. We're going to do that tomorrow. Just a quick couple of things before you leave tonight. Now, tomorrow morning...